You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's program, on Jack Warner TV, no less, the former FIFA vice president of that name addresses the people of Trinidad.
I have never had the privilege to speak to you before in an address on my own behalf. Over the past week, a series of events has taken place which have now caused me to come to the National Committee on Important Emerging Matters.
Warner goes on to deploy an interesting array of mixed metaphors as he says the gloves are off and also vows an avalanche of evidence. As the scandal snowballs at football's world governing body, my guests Raffaello Pantucci and Ivor Gaber are in the studio to give their view. No holds barred. And 26 years on from the Tiananmen Square massacre, we discuss the state of democracy and dissent in China and Hong Kong today. Also ahead, from Middle East envoy to champion of tolerance and reconciliation, we'll discuss Tony Blair's latest career move. And speaking of which, we'll ask, what should we pay our politicians as a planned pay rise for MPs ruffles feathers in the United Kingdom? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and Ivor Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex. Welcome both back to the programme. We will start with the latest in the unravelling of FIFA, the musical of which is hopefully already being worked on by someone somewhere. Former FIFA Vice President Jack Warner has made a diverting television appearance in his home country of Trinidad and Tobago, in which, among other claims, he said that he will demonstrate a link between FIFA and the 2010 election in that country. It should, of course, be recalled that Mr. Warner has also recently appeared on television brandishing a copy of The Onion as proof of American conspiracy against him. But even so, Ivor, I'll ask you first, just for fun here, what imaginable link is there between FIFA and an election in a smallish Caribbean country, do we think?
Pass. I mean... Jack Warner, as I recall, was a minister, of course, and I assume either he has had a difficult relationship with Sepp Blatter, one understands, in that the money wasn't flowing in the quite in the torrent that he'd come to expect. And so maybe he was worried that Sepp was planning... I have to tread carefully, there's laws and things, aren't there? But maybe Sepp was planning to do him down, because he was Minister of Sport, which gave him an enormous amount of leverage, obviously. So I guess that was the intervention that he thought that Blatter was trying to get him out of power. He clearly failed. But no, actually, he ceased to be Minister of Sport, but he didn't lose the election, as I recall.
Jack Warner is threatening to unleash all, as he puts it. He says he has documents implicating everybody in everything. Raffaello, I'm going to ask you tactfully, and I would appreciate, due to laws and whatever, a tactful answer. All things considered, especially given his performance over the last couple of weeks, how reliable a witness does Warner seem?
You know, I have to be perfectly honest to say that this whole story is one that's very much erupted in on my knowledge base as much as it has on the whole world. But amongst credible witnesses, he hasn't struck me so far as someone who necessarily I would put up in a court of law and expect to really win my case for me. Now, maybe I'm misreading it, but, you know, his brandishing, stories from The Onion as though they're factual. And, you know, it's not actually the first time we've had international leaders going around doing this.
No,
I seem to recall the Iranians did it at some point as well. You know, it still says to me that you're not really someone who's really checking up on every detail.
But the trouble is with this whole scandal, though, is that the more that comes out, the more it does actually read like something that not maybe The Onion would come up with and then discard for being too detached from reality to actually work as functioning satire. Well, it's mad.
I don't know about The Onion, but I don't. If you notice that when Mr. Warner gave his TV broadcast last night, the little logo said Warner TV.
We now, noted this. Yep.
It wasn't Warner Brothers. This is him declaring UDI. Right. But this man clearly controls everything in Trinidad and Tobago. So the fact that his news, his TV program gave him his broadcast unexpurgated, you know, does not surprise me if he thinks The Onion is a serious news story, because media studies is clearly not his major subject.
There does seem to be, we are at a point at which there seems to be another completely mad FIFA story appearing roughly every minute. Within the last hour, we have learned two things. Well, one, there has been a statement from Sepp Blatter announcing that he is starting work on reforming FIFA and getting to grips with its problem. And I'm sure we all
now
wish,
that he's quit, right?
I'm sure we all wish him the very best.
Hold your breath.
we all wish him the very, very best of luck with that. And also a story that has emerged in the last hour or so. The Football Association of Ireland now claiming that an amount was paid to them. The generally touted figure seems to be €5 million, not to pursue legal action over Thierry Henry's handball in a France versus Ireland World Cup qualifier in 2009. This is so balmy, I'm not even sure where we start. And basically, which either of you wants to jump in first can sort of like tell us how strange this sounds to you.
Well, there's a logic to it in this sense that at least they it was, for those listeners with poor memories, a crucial moment. It looked like Ireland was going to knock France out of the World Cup. Mm. Some people say Ireland was an early boycotter of the World Cup under Blatter.
Well, in fairness, they could hardly have done worse at the 2010 World Cup than France eventually did.
That's true. Right. Actually, I don't think France even scored a goal. But there was a great controversy about Thierry Henry, who up to that point had been a major hero figure in UK soccer, used his hand to score. And if you were going to throw FIFA money around, I guess stopping Ireland, who are allegedly taking legal action, although as somebody's mentioned, I'm not quite sure what legal action you take against the referees, but trying to stop Ireland disrupting the 2010 World Cup was probably a better use of FIFA funds than lining Mr. Warner's pockets, allegedly.
I thought you were about to allege an Irish connection to the 2010 general election in Trinidad and Tobago as well, which in fact would make no less sense than anything else we're hearing. A couple of other possibly more serious points. Raffaello, the UK government has said through a couple of sources that it stands ready to host the 2022 World Cup, should it be garnished from Qatar. Does this sort of talk help?
I just don't think it does. I remember listening, I think I was listening to Today Show this morning, and they had a former Minister for Culture saying pretty much the same thing and saying, we're ready, you know, we've got all the equipment in place, we could do it. I just don't think that helps. I think the fact that, you know, amongst the first people you saw coming out saying that this is all a conspiracy were President Putin saying that this is all part of the bigger conflict that he sees, which is just negative, is to me shows how actually a story that on some ways looks very superficial and silly and about football and sport can quickly escalate into something that really causes tensions between countries. Were they to take away the World Cup from Qatar and from Russia, I can't think that that's going to make any help or have any positive impact on either reforming FIFA or on relations between all these countries.
George Orwell was, of course, writing about Russian or at least Soviet football when he said that sport was war minus the shooting. Ivor, how serious could the diplomatic and strategic real-world consequences of this all get?
Well, I think quite serious, particularly, let's just look at Russia initially. For Russia, actually, both Russia and Qatar are clearly on a major soft power initiative. Russia was very happy, I think, with the results of the Sochi Olympics in terms of burnishing its reputation in the wake of the war in Ukraine. I think if the game was taken away from Russia in 2018 and went to the United States, for example, or Britain, which are seen as the devils in this piece, I think the consequences would be quite serious in terms of Cold War. Qatar would be slightly different, although one cannot underestimate the support there is outside of Europe for taking the World Cup to places where it doesn't normally go. But I think even the most fanatical Asian or African football executive might just in their calmer moments concede that giving the World Cup to a country where in August, which is the traditional time World Cups are played, temperatures get into the 50s plus, and there is a real risk of death for crowds and players wasn't perhaps FIFA's most sensible decision. There might have been other motives behind it.
A couple of other developments today, which we will doubtless hear more from in the ensuing days and weeks, is the FBI is now apparently investigating Brazil's World Cup bid, for which obviously was successful for the most recent World Cup. Australian police are considering an investigation into Australia's failed 2022 bid. Raffaello, final thought on this from you. Are we getting any sense yet of where or when this is likely to end?
I think it's going to end with a giant trial somewhere in Guantanamo Bay with Sepp Blatter sitting in the dock, you know, and finally it will have some resolution. Yeah. I honestly don't see where this goes on. I can see it's going to drag on. We're going to continue to get this pitter-patter of stories. I think we're going to be talking about this for at least another year or two.
Just as a PS, I imagine that I don't know Swiss extradition law, but I can imagine it can be dragged out for many, many months, maybe years, while they fight to resist being taken back to meet the FBI.
But I think it's been it's happened in the past, isn't it? I think Roman Polanski at one point was fighting it from here, and I'm not sure that he managed to hold on. And then I think the fact that you had these public arrests, very public sort of arrests, taking people out of a meeting in a hotel, says to me that I think the Americans have done a lot of groundwork to make sure that the Swiss are on side about this.
Okay, well, we will doubtless come back to this ad infinitum in future. Let's look now at China. 1989 is remembered in Europe as the year that communist totalitarianism fell to democracy, and in China it has more or less the opposite resonance. 26 years ago today, the People's Liberation Army was turned loose on people seeking liberation. Nobody knows for sure how many were killed in Tiananmen Square. The Chinese authorities were not counting, but the toll was at least in the hundreds. It may well have been much higher. Raffaello, I'll ask you first. It's obviously been a more significant Tiananmen anniversary this year than in most years because of the protests we've seen over the last little while in Hong Kong. And every step of the way, as that protest gathered inside, the global media especially invoked Tiananmen more and more, worried that was it going to happen again, or at least thought that maybe the Chinese authorities had learnt something from it and wouldn't pull the same stunt in the 21st century in Hong Kong. How big a deal is it to China, Tiananmen Square? Because for the rest of the world, it seems like a defining event in our perception of China. Does it seem that way inside China?
I mean, what's fascinating to me about this whole incident is that if you talk to an awful lot of younger Chinese, and there are an awful lot of them, they just don't know what this incident was. It was something that happened years and years ago, and it's not something they have any clear recollection of. I remember when I worked in China, I had a colleague who saw the famous tank man photo, you know, that the picture of the guy in Tiananmen Square standing before the long row of tanks. And they had no idea what this was. They were like, what is this funny picture? And who is this guy? And then it was explained, and they're like, oh, it's that incident. Well, who cares? That's the old China. That's not now. And I think that's in some ways what's quite worrying about this, is that as time has gone on, the authorities have managed to kind of turn the page on this incident. And within China, while, you know, there is a sense that there is a sort of oppressive government, there is a sense that they've kind of managed to move beyond that element, even though, in fact, nowadays, political dissent is still very, very tightly sort of controlled. I think that the Hong Kong incident, what happened in Hong Kong was interesting, but I think it didn't surprise me. I know that there was a lot of sort of hyperventilation around the Chinese government reacting by sending in the forces and, you know, having a similar sort of Tiananmen response to that. But I never thought that that was really going to happen, because I just think that the response in China has become much more sophisticated, and they realize that there are ways of stifling these things out that don't require mass deployment of forces.
Ivor, the U.S. State Department issued a release today saying the U.S. continues to call for an official accounting of the victims, the release of those still serving Tiananmen-related sentences, and an end to the harassment and detention of those who wish to peacefully commemorate the anniversary. 26 years later, is there something, and I'm not saying this is what I think, I'm having a crack at being devil's advocate here, is there something in the idea that that was the old China, that that isn't the new China, and that it is therefore somewhat unfair to keep beating Beijing over the head with this?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think China has moved on in a number of ways since then, particularly, obviously, in terms of economic development. And in my experience, I've done a little bit of work in China, and I have quite a lot of contact with Chinese students day to day. You get little pockets of free expression, if you like, but the pockets are very strictly defined. For example, you can have some discussions on Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter, about incidents like Hong Kong. My students were telling me they were talking about Hong Kong in ways they wouldn't talk about Tiananmen. that they are more aware of Tiananmen when they come to the West. They start hearing about it. So I just wonder, and I'm not an expert on China, but I wonder what the impact of so many hundreds of thousands of young Chinese coming to study in the West and then going back. I don't want to sound a dewy-eyed optimist, because I certainly, when I go back to China and meet some of my Chinese ex-journalism students, discover it hasn't taken them long to sort of fall neatly back into fully aware of media freedom and journalist independence, but doing the job that they're paid to do. Mm. But I just wonder, do you think it's having an undermining or liberating effect in terms of the hundreds of thousands now going back?
My sense of is that you look at the sorts of massive populations that do come out and then that go back home and that do have some sort of free expression. They do understand these discussions. They do understand these political debates, and they do appreciate the Western view and their view, and they do have a perspective on it. But at the end of the day, they look at the larger system and they say, this system is working and I'm making money out of it, and I will sort of go with the flow. And I think in some ways that's the more depressing thing out of it, is that in fact, well, you know, the lesson is not necessarily that they don't know, they forget these things. It's one, on the one hand, it's increasingly becoming ancient history, so they don't think about it anymore. But it's increasingly because, you know what, I can get a good job now, you know, I can have two cars, I can live in a big flat, I can do all these sorts, have all these consumer items, and that's sort of more important to me. And having that kind of a lifestyle is more important than being able to discuss that these people who just want to complain and upset the system are out there doing. And in some ways, I think that's what the government is sort of relying upon, the sense of this mass buy into the system, and the sense that, well, okay, in that case, you know, the fact that you can jail, you know, Uyghur dissidents like Ilham Tohti for a life sentence for essentially teaching some of their students, you know, is just something that people won't actually take to the streets about.
Yeah, and I do notice a trend that when you talk to Chinese, I obviously teach journalism students, what area of journalism are you interested in? Entertainment, sport, business. I've yet, I think, to meet the Chinese journalism student who wants to go into political journalism, because, you know, it ain't very interesting in China.
You see, but I think there's a danger there in concluding that there isn't an interest at all in that direction, because you do find that if you look at some of the Chinese newspapers and magazines like Caixin or Caijing, they do some really good investigative pieces, yeah. You know, and there is this sort of investigation, and that really does cut into looking at the political patronage networks. Now, there is a question about how much they've been permitted to investigate those ones versus others.
How far their investigation goes. I was running a course for investigative journalists for financial journalists in China, and they were saying well, how free are you to investigate? And they said, look, we can investigate particular concern in China about foreign investors being ripped off. But they used to say to me, there's two restraints. Mm. One is if the reporting touches Beijing level. So we can expose corrupt local or regional officials, but, you know, we keep our hands off the Politburo. And secondly, we can only do it retrospectively to report the trial, but we'll give the background, and then we'll say another triumph for Chinese justice. Hmm. We can't be seen to be the motivators. But nonetheless, within those parameters, they are doing some decent investigative work. Mm.
Okay, well, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Raffaello Pantucci and Ivor Gaber. Coming up next, it didn't take long, Blair's back.
It's full steam ahead with the new transport-themed issue of Monocle that includes our survey of the best in class from cars to trams, planes to trains. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the design section, we rail for better design aboard the newly launched Union Pearson Express train in Toronto. We also report on a Hellenic revival in the fashion industry and survey the sunnier offerings from the world of outdoor furniture.
In the edit section, we make ourselves at home in Juarez for this month's property prospectus, meet a perky coffee machine maker in Tuscany, and break bread in Bondi with a few healthy recipes from chef Guy Turland.
The June issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to sign up now.
And welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Raffaello Pantucci and Ivor Gaber. Now, Tony Blair's resignation last month as Middle East envoy representing the quartet occasioned a global chorus of mockery, not all of it justified. Despite what many headlines suggested, even in newspapers which should know better, he was never actually as such a peace envoy. He has not been unemployed long, however. It has been announced today that Tony Blair is to be the new chair of something called the European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation. be honest with me. 24 hours ago, had either of you ever heard of the European Council on Tolerance and Reconciliation?
Nope.
Of course not. I was debating taking a different line there, but no, I mean, honesty is the best policy, right?
in your doubtless assiduous research before coming onto this program today, what have we learned about it? What do we understand the ECTR to be?
Seems to be involved in anti-Semitism in Europe. That's what I seem to have grasped.
It's against it, right?
They don't like this kind of stuff. So that's what they're for, and that's what we know. And somehow Tony Blair has decided that this is his new cause to champion. I mean, there is a link to what he was doing before, I suppose, you know, and the fact it was looking at the Quartet and Israel-Palestine, but...
The previous chair, the outgoing chair, is Polish former president Aleksander Kwasniewski, which I've almost, that's a terrible attempt to pronounce
it. It wasn't bad. I can't even pronounce
at this point. I'm the former president of Poland. Let's just call him that. Is this, do you think, Ivor, a box office appointment? Let's get Tony Blair before FIFA snap him up.
That's a good thought for the next president of FIFA, of
course. Well, exactly.
You heard it first here. You know, this is where the campaign kicked off.
It's him or possibly George Galloway all up for Rahman.
That's another interesting thought. I'm going to be briefly serious. Tony Blair, I know, has had a long-standing interest in the Middle East. When he was leader of the Labour Party, he used to attend the annual meeting of the Labour Friends of Israel. He took a great interest in the area. I mean, clearly most people in the Middle East saw him as pro-Israel. He had very good connections with the Jewish community. His chief fundraiser was Lord Levy, who was also his advisor on the Middle East. So he's had a long-standing interest in that area. And I guess his thinking after the Quartet job ceased was, I've still got a bit of time on my hands. I know about these things. And to be fair to Tony Blair, I was at a meeting today where one of his most, to be fair, I'll name it, Len McCluskey, who's a senior trade unionist here, who's a bitter critic of Tony Blair, did, before denouncing him, said people forget about his major contribution to peace in Ireland. I mean, that's slightly off the track. But, you know, Blair does have a international track record, whether it's in Ireland, Bosnia or Kosovo or Sierra Leone, of intervention, some of it successful, and I didn't say the word Iraq.
In my own assiduous researches into the ECTR, I've discovered that they're quite keen on ideas like widening the definition of hate speech to make it easier to prosecute, and also widening the number of countries or encouraging further countries to outlaw Holocaust denial. Speaking as a free speech crank myself, my reservation about Holocaust denial, which is the obvious one, is does it not just lend crackpots and dingbats a sort of the respectability of martyrs? Shouldn't these people just be free to pronounce their views and the rest of us be free to laugh at them?
I think the Holocaust denial legislation is one that's actually, I always wonder if it's more linked to specific countries and their histories. So if you have a country like Germany or Austria, I can understand why they have legislation like this, because they have this history in this direction. I do wonder sometimes if it's helpful if it's also banned in other countries where they don't have that kind of connection to the specific event. So I tend to be ambivalent about it and can see how in some contexts it makes sense and in some contexts it doesn't feel like it necessarily should. And it might, in fact, do what you say, which is, you know, make people martyrs who otherwise would just be disregarded as crazy people on the internet.
I mean, I share your blind free speech fanaticism and I'm very uncomfortable with Holocaust denial. And I think there is a distinction between Holocaust denial and inciting racial hatred, which I am keen to restrict.
Mm. But any sensible country has laws against, certainly there's laws against incitement to racial violence or incitement to violence full stop in any sensible country. Isn't that sufficient?
No, not just to violence. No, I think hatred as well should, incitement to racial hatred, I think, as it is in this country, should be a crime. But you can be a Holocaust denier without explicitly be inciting racial hatred. So I join you in your lack of comfort with Holocaust denial. I mean, I'm now going to express my ignorance as a professor of journalism. I'm not sure. I don't think Holocaust denial is a crime in this country.
It's not. No, it's certainly not in this country. The ECTR is also, I mean, it strikes me that the problem with doubtless well-intentioned organisations like the ECTR is that the only people who are likely to pay attention to them are the people who don't actually need to.
Well, I mean, I think that there is a question here about, you know, if you look at Europe and what we've seen happening in the past few years, look at France, for example, and you look at France and the number of terrorist incidents they've had recently, which have targeted the Jewish community quite specifically. We've had that happen in Denmark as well. There is a sense that, you know, at least amongst a particularly hardcore fanatical Islamist wing, Jews are sort of open targets. And you're seeing a result is people are leaving. You know, there has been an exflow. And I don't know if all the numbers that we see quoted are totally accurate, but we have seen more people of a Jewish faith leaving Europe because they perceive that this is not a welcome environment for them anymore. So I can understand why organizations like this do need to exist and do have a voice. And it is important to have them represented. Whether Tony Blair is the best advocate of that remains for me to be seen.
Well, Tony Blair has become a proverbial example of the money to be made after leaving high political office. In the UK, the argument is again being had about what to pay people who are in it. The body which sets MPs' pay is suggesting a 10% hike to £74,000 a year for backbenchers. The government, doubtless mindful that few of the consequent headlines will exclaim, and quite right and about time too, is asking for the raise to be abandoned. Several opposition MPs have said they'll decline the raise or give it to charity. Are we ever going to have a sensible public debate about this or not?
No.
Excellent.
there is a history. Obviously, there's a history to this. I mean, I have to say, trying to be as fair as I can, I don't think £67,000 is a commensurate salary for somebody with responsibilities of an MP these days. I know there are very many extras in terms of travel and so forth, but it does seem to me to be on the low side.
It's more than twice what they get in Spain.
But a fraction of what they get in Kenya.
Or Italy, for that
per capita, yes. it's about half what they get in Italy, or indeed Australia.
Well, there you go.
And I do think that there is something to be said for the need to link it automatically, as they used to do in the past, linked to a certain grade of civil servants, so it went up automatically. The problem is the civil servants had a very effective trade union, the First Division Association, so the pay shot up. This all takes us back to MPs' expenses, and the reason we got into trouble they got into trouble with expenses was for year after year, dating back to the 1970s, MPs were told, look, don't push hard on pay because the public don't like it, but you know,
send in some invoices for moat cleaning and duck houses, and you can make it up that way. Raffaello, is Britain unique in absolutely resenting any amount of sort of comfort extended to its political leaders?
No, I think there's a lot of other countries that probably thrive on this as well. I can't think of any examples off the top of my head, I'll be honest. But what I found fascinating about this story was this body that apparently chooses MPs' pay is meant to be an independent body. And so they've gone ahead and done this, seemingly against the wishes of the thing. And it's just this sort of bizarre idea that this entity that's trying to do you a favor, hey, I'll give you a good raise, and you're like, no, I don't want it. And then,
well, there's a double paradox, if you can have, because this new body, the independent parliamentary IPCR, anyway,
there you go,
is hated by MPs. They regard it as far too officious in policing their pay, their expenses. When I talk to MPs, they talk about what so and so, and it unites all MPs together. And all of a sudden, it turns around and says, "Oh, would you like some more money?"
So, I'd be fairly unresentful of somebody who wanted to give me a 10% pay hike. I have to say, is there another way forward here? What about just doing the thing where you? And I think this was actually suggested by Labour at one point in the election campaign, which now seems like it happened years ago for some reason. Is there something to be said for just whacking up their wages and forbidding them from making money on the side?
Well, that was the scandal that happened around the... there was a documentary on Dispatches, I think, where they caught Jack Straw
and Malcolm Rifkind.
That's right. Yeah. And they, after that, you know, Malcolm Rifkind tried to make in some ways the case that Ivor was just making about how, you know, maybe MPs are undercompensated. It's a very high profile. It's a very big job and, you know, you should get paid a better salary for doing it. But you'll remember the opprobrium when he tried to make that case and it didn't really fly. And especially coming out of the mouth of a Tory MP, it made it even harder to really sell. So, you know, I don't know that... I don't know that it's ever going to be an easy battle for them to try to win.
Brief final thought on this, Ivor?
Well, I think it goes back to what you said. I was just listening to Raphael and thinking of the solution. There's no solution. It's just going to be one of those things that run and run. Frankly, in terms of the big political picture and the economy, it's peanuts, but it's quite fun.
Ivor Gaber and Raffaello Pantucci, thanks very much for joining us here at Midori House. That's all for today's episode. It was produced by Alice Block, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tamor Haveda Williams. And our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. For the next half hour, Fernando Augusto Pacheco is keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist on the Atlantic Shift. At 1900 hours, Andrew Tuck will be in with The Urbanist. At 2200 hours, The Monocle Daily. This show returns tomorrow, also hosted by me at 1800 London time. For this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.